Iowa's plants may be dormant and even under a layer of ice today, but that doesn't mean there's nothing growing in the state. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension will be here, along with Denny Schrock, coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer for the Hort Department at ISU. We'll talk about growing and caring for orchids, one of Denny's specialties, and we'll also find out how people can grow their gardening knowledge base through the Master Gardener Program this winter. And, of course, Denny and Richard will answer your questions about the plants in your life. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and orchids seem to be everywhere right now. They're incredibly beautiful, but can be a little intimidating. This hour, we'll talk about how to take care of orchids, and of course, we will answer your questions about the plants in your life. Horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension is here. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And Denny Schrock, coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Hort Department at Iowa State University, is also here. Good morning, Denny.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you both so much for being here today. And I want to start with some news that we heard this week about the emerald ash borer being discovered in Creston, which is in Union County, western Iowa. Of course, this is a time of year when I didn't expect that we would actually hear anything about the emerald ash borer. Richard, what does this mean that the emerald ash borer has been found far away from the original quarantine area in Iowa?
Well, previously the counties were in eastern Iowa. This is in southwestern Iowa. So there's another point for it to spread, unfortunately. Apparently they were doing some tree trimming, and the arborist noticed that he saw signs of the emerald ash borer, and yes, it was, in fact, that insect.
So it probably arrived in that part of the state by somebody transporting firewood.
Most likely.
Is the best guess.
Right, right.
It didn't probably spread there on its own because it doesn't travel that far that fast usually.
Right. It typically by itself only move 2 to 5 miles per year. So that's why it's so important, because now you have a point where it can spread basically in western Iowa.
All right. And is there anything to be done about it this time of year if you're in Union County and you think about, I have an ash tree?
Nothing. But you might be thinking about next spring. If you live in Creston or nearby areas, do you want to, if you have some ash trees, if they're nice, healthy trees, very important trees in your landscape, you might want to consider treating them next spring.
All right. And I'm sure we will talk a lot more about the emerald ash borer when the spring comes. Let's talk more about things that are actually growing this time of year. And Denny, I know that you are a bit of an orchid expert.
Well, I've worked on a couple of books on orchids and have quite a few in my greenhouse and house. So.
All right. I think that qualifies you. And they do seem to be all over the place right now. Richard and I were just commenting on this, particularly, I guess I've seen a lot of them at Hy-Vee stores, but in other nurseries as well. They seem to be something that a lot of people are looking at and buying this year. And of course, they are beautiful. If you see them at a garden center, in a nursery, in a flower department, and you think, boy, I would love to have one of those in my home, what do you need to think about before buying it?
Well, the first thing is that, yes, as you mentioned, orchids have a little bit of a notoriety as being a slightly temperamental, but most of the orchids we're seeing for sale in the big box stores or garden centers and other places like that are the Phalaenopsis or moth orchids, and that is one of the easiest orchids to take care of. So as long as you have a good warm home, they like room temperature, you know, around 65, 70 degrees during the day and perhaps down to 60 at night. They don't like it very cold. And if you can keep high humidity, that's usually one of the biggest things for an average home is this time of year when we have the heat on, the home dries out, you get the static electricity as you're walking across the carpet and zapping. If it's that dry, the orchids aren't going to like it.
All right, you just described my home. Cold, 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 and dry. So that is definitely something to think about. And also this time of year, of course, when you put something near a window, it's awfully cold near a window. Is that a problem with orchids as well?
Well, as I said, if the most of the orchids don't like temperatures much below 60 degrees. As long as you can maintain that 60 degrees, most of them will pull through just fine. There are a few very, very tropical ones that need it warmer than that, but the moth orchids can take it down to 60 quite well, and actually they need a little bit of time down at that temperature to set their flower buds. So if you have too warm a home, they may not rebloom well for you. And the other thing to think about is these moth orchids, if they're just budded up, they probably will continue blooming for you for several months without any real special care at all. Those blossoms last for a long, long time. And maintaining your home at that cooler side actually preserves them for a longer time. So you make an advantage of that.
All right. So this may actually be a great time if you're to bring a moth orchid home.
Yes. Yes. This is a great time.
What kind of light do they need?
They should have bright light. It doesn't need to be greenhouse-type light or even a conservatory or sunroom-type light, but it should be a nice bright light window. I have mine in my dining room in a bay, but the bay is under the front porch deck, so it's not like it's getting real direct light, but it's a nice bright light.
Okay. So you don't want it directly in the sun, but you do want it to have plenty of light.
Right. That's correct.
How often do they need to be watered?
The frequency of watering depends a little bit on the medium they're growing in and what kind of container they're in, but on average, about once a week. The Phalaenopsis or moth orchids are what are called epiphytes. They don't grow in actual soil. So when you purchase them, you'll probably see them growing in maybe sphagnum moss or maybe bark. Usually most of them are growing in a bark type mix. And what you do is you just put a little water on weekly to keep that bark or sphagnum moss moist but not soaking wet. That's one of the things that can cause problems with your orchids rotting away is if you keep them too wet. So probably no more than once a week for watering. If they are in a plastic container that tends to hold the moisture in a little bit longer, so they may only need watering once every 10 days or so. So just kind of touch the medium a little bit, and if it feels a little bit like a moist, wrung-out dish rag, it's probably moist enough and doesn't need any more water.
And is it usually advisable to just keep them in the container that you buy them in?
Generally, the ones you get them in, they're going to be fine for at least this first year or so of their orchids are not real fast growers. If you're really into orchids and get the little seedling orchids, it may take 4 or 5 years for them to reach blooming size. So that's why it's real nice to purchase the ones that are already blooming so you don't have to wait a long time. But that also means you don't have to repot them very quickly. Now, perhaps by next year, if you lucky enough to keep them going, you may need to repot at that point. A good reason or way to tell if they need repotting is if that bark medium that they're growing in starts breaking down and holds moisture too long, then you may need to repot and use a fresh source of bark so that they don't stay too wet.
All right. And when you bring them home from the store, you mentioned that obviously they usually are sold when they're blooming, and that's the really showy type display that we see at the stores right now, and makes, of course, a wonderful gift to bring this beautiful flowering plant into somebody's home. But let's talk a little bit about the blooming cycle of the orchid. You mentioned that those blooms should last for a while.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Well, the blooms last for a good long time. As I said, you can easily get a couple months out of them and maybe even several months. I know some of my moth orchids I've had would start like this time of year in December, and I would still have them blooming well into March. And then look closely at those bloomed out stems. It's good to cut off the old faded blossoms, but don't cut the stalk back too far. The moth orchids bloom on a long stalk and the individual blooms come out at the end. But they often will send out a secondary or even a third bloom stalk if you cut back just as far as the blossoms go. So don't cut back onto that stalk. It may look a little odd at first to have this kind of stub sticking up there, but if there's a node or a branching point, the flower will often send out a second bloom stalk, and you may get several more months of bloom out of that second one without really doing much additional work at all.
And Richard, when we were talking about seeing orchids in the store, you mentioned that you've seen blue orchids.
Yes, those blue ones, yes.
At the store. Now, there's no such thing as a blue orchid, right?
Well, there are blue orchids, but the ones you're seeing in the store, there is no such thing as a blue moth orchid. And those are the ones we're seeing. But you know,
So why are we seeing them at the store, Denny?
It's because people love the color blue in flowers. And an entrepreneurial grower discovered how to dye the white moth orchids and make them turn blue. Or you may also see it St. Patrick's Day green ones that have been dyed, and I've seen some purple ones as well. The thing that people need to realize is, yes, they're going to be beautiful at the time if they like that particular color, but if they go through a secondary bloom cycle, they're going to revert back and be white. It's not a permanent change. It's just a temporary dye that dyes the flowers and buds that are there at that time.
Okay, so that's important to know if you think you're purchasing a blue moth orchid.
That's right.
Now, if you had to make a comparison, we talk about African violets on the show on occasion, and I know they can be very tricky. Are orchids as difficult or more difficult than African violets, would you think?
I would say that in general, orchids are probably more difficult, but these moth orchids that we're talking about probably are very much in that same range as African violets. They're really quite easy. Perhaps the biggest problem people has is they fuss over them too much. Like I said, what I do is I keep mine through the winter months in my dining room bay window, but over the summer they go outdoors under my covered deck. And the heat and humidity, they love that humidity. So when I'm watering other plants, I splash a little water on them, but they don't get any attention or care. Very little fertilizer, maybe once a month they don't get that. Yeah, I don't fertilize that much. Maybe once or twice a year is probably more what mine get. They suffer a little bit more, and sometimes that forces some bloom out of them.
All right. Well, we are going to take a break here in just a minute. We'll be back to answer your questions in a moment. Your questions about orchids or any houseplants or any of the plants in your life at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Denny, before we get to the break, recently you and I talked about the Master Gardener Program. And of course, you are the coordinator of the Master Gardener Program. You have winter classes coming up soon, right?
That's right. They'll be starting in mid-January. The registration deadline for that is January 10th, so coming up right after the first of the year.
All right, and we've put up a link to the Master Gardener Program page on our Facebook page. You can also, of course, just search for the Master Gardener Program at Iowa State University and find out about those classes and what counties they will be in this winter. My guests today are Denny Schrock, coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Hort Department at ISU, and horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Denny Schrock, coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. You are welcome to join our conversation with your questions today at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And you can also post on our Facebook page. And let's get right to the phones. Carol is on the line in Gladbrook. Hi, Carol.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your question today?
Well, I have an orchid that I've had for about a year and a half. And first off, I want to encourage anyone to try it. I've had so much fun with my orchid.
Oh, that's great.
And it's bloomed beautifully. In fact, it bloomed for almost 5 months. But my question is, at this time, I'm wondering how to repot it or if it's possible to divide it. I've got a plant that's growing to the left, and all of these roots are coming out to the right, and it's looking a little monstrous.
All right. the dividing and repotting depends a little bit on the type of orchid and its growth pattern. Is this one of the moth orchids that...
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a white one, beautiful white.
Okay. Yeah, the moth orchid is typically what we call a monopodial orchid. That is, it has just one main stem that grows longer and longer. Occasionally, mm-hmm. they'll send out a side shoot, but they're not ones that spread rapidly side to side. So they typically don't need division very often, but if you're lucky enough to have one that has thrown off several side shoots, you may be able to divide that, as long as it each division would have some of those aerial roots as part of it.
Okay.
But yeah, you need to make sure that they have some of those aerial roots so that you can have some source of them to pull up their moisture and nutrients.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Good luck with that, Carol. Thanks a lot for mm-hmm. your call. And next up, we've got Ellen on the line in West Branch. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I'm a novice orchid grower. I have some Oncidiums, I have a Zygote Petulum, and then I have several from the BLC class. Now, I have two questions. One is the BLC one that I have. It's very large. I was inherited it, and it has kind of a metal cage around it to make the leaves grow up, because they tend to be big and grow out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really got roots growing out of the pot all over. It's only bloomed once for me in about 4 years. And I'm thinking, how in the world would I repot this because of this metal cage? And the other question I have regarding a BLC, I got a small seedling one, and I got it about 3 years ago. It's never bloomed, and I think it probably won't right away. But some of the big fleshy leaves are getting black spots, and I don't know what they aren't. I've tried to look at them and figure why I'm getting them. There's some in the middle, some on the edges. The way I water once a week with distilled water with a very weak, every once in a while weak fertilizer solution. I put the pot containing the orchid into another pot, and then I bring that water up to about an inch from the top of the pot, and I let it set there for about 10 minutes, and then I take it out, and I put it in a cash pot that has bark in the bottom so the excess moisture can drain out. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Okay, well, first we'll address the watering issue.
Before that, can you tell the rest of us what a BLC orchid is?
Okay, yes, we'll do that. The BLC stands for Brassolalio Cattleya, which is mouthful for the genus. And it's an example of a man-made genus or hybrid or grex. What they've done, there's one genus called Brassea, one called Lalia, and one called Cattleya, and they've crossed all these genera into one that's called Brassolalia Cattleya. And as you can imagine, rather than saying that full thing, the orchidists often abbreviate to BLC.
Okay, and it's a big, showy orchid?
Yes, it's like if people are familiar with Cattleya orchids, the big corsage ones. It's in that family. So it looks like those big corsage Cattleya orchids.
Okay. All right. Now on to the watering. Thank you.
All right. It sounds like what you're doing with the watering is fine. You're not getting the foliage wet, and you're making sure that the roots don't stay wet too long. So I don't think that the black spots are a watering issue. It may be actually a fungal problem. There are some fungal diseases that orchids can get, and that the black spots are pretty typical of that. We may not be able to tell without actually seeing, you know, an actual sample, whether it's truly a fungus or not. You mentioned that some is on the middle of the leaves and some on the edge, which makes me think it's not, you know, drying out too much. If it's showing up in the middle, it's more likely to be a fungal problem. So may need a fungicide, or if it's confined to a particular portion of the plant, you might be able to trim it out and prevent it from spreading further.
Would you just cut the leaf off?
Yes, just cut the leaf off.
Cut the leaf off. Okay.
Right.
That would be very helpful. And then what about this repotting with this metal cage around it?
Okay. Well, most of the BLC family are a different type of growth than the moth orchids that we're talking about. They're what are called sympodial. That is, they do send out side shoots pretty readily. So
yeah. That's
something that you can actually get in there and cut the thing apart. And don't worry about being a little bit rough with it, orchids are tough. As you know, they've got those thick, fleshy leaves and pseudo bulbs. And so you can actually get in there and cut through. And once you've cut the plant apart into smaller sections, you should be able to pull it through and pull it out of that cage if you'd like.
So do you pull the cage up off the plant out of the pot first, or how do you do this?
Yeah, that's probably the easiest thing to do. It depends a little bit on the plant itself. But yeah, you may be able to just pull the whole thing out of the pot, and then you can see whether it's going to be easier to pull the plant up through the cage or actually back down through the cage. Because those leaves are pointing up, it may be easier to pull it down through, especially if you've cut through it first.
Well, actually, they've grown through the cage and they're pointing out. I mean, these things get huge.
Okay.
So it
may take a little bit of finagling and finessing to not break off a lot of those. But if you cut it apart into a couple sections, you probably can pull it back through the cage without doing too much damage to that foliage.
Okay. How do these orchids get a fungus? Because I keep this in a sunroom that has windows on three sides. They're not in direct sunlight. And the room I keep at between 63 and 68 degrees year-round. I don't let them outside. I don't have any bugs or anything in there.
Yeah. Fungal spores usually spread through the air. So the spores are in the air. It's not anything you've done necessarily. It's just those spores are there, and if they land on a surface that is a good growing medium for them, it can get started.
Huh. Well, I really thank you so much, and I just love this program. And today I'm home from work, so I can call.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And next up, this may be outside of your field of expertise, both of you, but we'll give it a try. Jenny is on the line in Ames. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a late summer question, early fall. I have sweet potato vines in my planters, and they made beautiful sweet potatoes. They are okay to eat, right?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
If they haven't frozen or anything of that nature, if they haven't spoiled, they are edible. Now, the tubers that you find with the ornamental sweet potatoes, they were selected for their ornamental qualities. So their eating quality may not quite match those of the typical sweet potato, but they are edible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Jenny, thanks a lot for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Next up, Craig is on the line in Grafton. Hi, Craig.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm wondering about a recommendation for shrubs to plant kind of as a divider on a property line in town. That would attract birds. That would be good bushes to attract wildlife, particularly birds.
Okay. One possibility would be some of the viburnums. I'm thinking of like the American cranberry bush viburnum, the arrowwood viburnum. So they would be good choices. Possibly there are some. Smaller crab apples that you could almost utilize as a shrub, they might be a possibility.
It may also depend on whether you're wanting it, a divider as a screen or just a divider, because there are some smaller ones or medium-sized ones like the choke cherry or choke berries, aronia. There's a red and a black choke berry that produce fruit birds would like. Some of the currants, like clove currant, has lovely yellow fragrant flowers in springtime and then edible currant berries in the summertime. So lots of choices there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Craig, thanks a lot for your call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and you're welcome to join us with your questions at 866-780-9100. Let's get to a couple of email questions. This is from Ryan in Galesburg. Do you have a recommendation for a cost-effective way to protect 300 12 to 24-inch trees that I will be planting in the spring? Using agricultural draining tile seems like a decent possibility, but it's black and can get hot and hurt the bark. Any other thoughts?
Boy, that's a large number. What they might want to do, there are some companies like A.M. Leonard, and they have a web page. And you can buy various protective devices, and you can buy them in large quantities. And price-wise, they're not so bad. So you might want to go that route where you go to a large distributor like A.M. Leonard and see what they have.
You could also check with an orchard supply place because commercial orchardists, of course, need to protect their young planted trees. And they have what are called spiral tree wraps. They're polyethylene, and they're only about an inch or so in diameter. So for the small 12 to 24 inch trees, they'd work pretty nicely that you protect both from rabbits and from sun scald. So, and again, if you get 300 of them, you should get a pretty good quantity discount on them.
All right. Another email question. This is from Matt. I planted some peonies this fall and have now seen that a few of them are no longer under the dirt, but rather at ground level. Will this hurt them? Is there anything I can do now, or should I just make sure that come spring they are correctly planted approximately an inch underground?
Well, if you're seeing the buds, that's a little bit too shallow. Ideally, they should be 1 to 2 inches below the ground. So possibly next spring they can add a little bit of soil to make sure that they're at the proper depth.
Can he add soil now?
I think I'd wait till spring, early spring.
Do you think they'll make it?
Yeah.
Okay.
What they could do if they want to make sure is if they have some, let's say, shredded leaves or maybe some straw or maybe, for example, if they have a Christmas tree, when they take it down, they can take off some branches and cover the peonies with those branches.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Eric is on the line in Anamosa. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
So I'm managing some forest here in Anamosa, and we're trying to get rid of some invasive species and to increase oak regeneration. So we've been doing some thinning and prescribed fire of the leaf litter in the forest. I was curious if there's possibilities that it will injure the lumber just with these low-intensity fires.
Well, with that, I guess I would have you contact your district forester. They basically deal with forestry issues. I'm sure they can give you an answer. So if you go to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and specifically to the Forestry Bureau, you can find a list of your district foresters and contact that person. It's a little bit out of my area. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just wanted to hopefully bring some awareness to people. Burning timbers is a good thing. So thank you.
Eric, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Sharon is on the line in Johnston. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I bought this orchid at a Fairway store this fall. And it was blooming beautifully, and it bloomed for a couple of months. And then when the blooms dropped off, I had seen a show on TV that said to cut back 4 nodes, and it would eventually rebloom. Well, I did that, and it's been a couple of months, and nothing's happened. And the bloom stems, there were 2 on the plant and still are, but instead of being green, they're turning brown.
All right. Yeah. If the bloom stem has turned brown, it's a pretty good indication that it's not going to bloom on that part. However, they may still bloom from further down on the base. If they're not brown all the way back to the leaves, if there's still a green portion towards the bottom of that stem, it may still come through. And
I shouldn't cut off any of the brown above the green, if there's any green left, or just leave that alone until something happens?
If it's dried and brown and crispy, go ahead and cut it off. But don't remove it if it's still quite firm and has the possibility of growing back out. So you may not get bloom immediately after cutting back the first time, but that's where the next cycle of bloom will come. It may take a period of cooler temperatures for that bloom to regenerate. So you may not get another bloom on that same stem until next year at this time, or if you're lucky, you may get one yet this coming spring.
Wonder if the other bloom stem turns brown all the way down too, then I won't have any blossoms at all on this plant ever?
No, that's not the case. They can send out new bloom stalks from the base, yes.
Oh.
So even though these 2 may die back, that doesn't mean you're done for with this orchid. It can still put out some new bloom stalks.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Sharon. And before we get to the break, we had a call. Randy from Iowa County couldn't stay on the line, but he says, if there's still fruit on your trees, what do you need to do, if anything?
Okay. What kind of fruit?
I'm guessing pears, but that's a...
I guess you let them just fall to the ground or okay. Animals eat them, whatever. So...
All right, apples, I guess, is what okay. He was asking about.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, the apples are frozen solid right. enough or have been that they're not going to be edible by humans, but they certainly can still be great for wildlife. So if you want to pick them off and feed them to deer or put them to the side for birds to feed on, that could be a possibility just so they don't create a mess on the ground.
Okay, but they're not necessarily going to hurt the tree or anything by just hanging out there.
No.
All right, and they'll be gone by spring.
Yes, they will.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension and Denny Schrock, who is coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. You can also join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And with me, horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension. Denny Schrock is also here. He's coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. And you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. We've been talking a lot about orchids this hour, but you can call with any of your plant questions. And we have an email, I think, from somebody that you know well, Denny, who wants to put in a plug for opportunities for master gardeners to partner with the 4-H program. And he mentions, this is from Phil Heckman, who's a 4-H youth program specialist. He says, there are some trainings on youth and gardening coming up in the central Iowa area from the 4-H program, including an opportunity, a healthy living curricula training on February 12th from 9 to 4 at the Polk County Extension Office and March 1st from 9 to 4 at the Hardin County Extension Office. And he wants to mention that those trainings will cover growing in the garden, the elementary school curriculum, growing in the garden, local foods and healthy living, and a Where We Live series, history of the land, weaving the food web, and living with the land. So winter seems to be a great time to learn a lot about gardening and learn about teaching about gardening as well.
That's very true. And Phil and I have worked together on a grant proposal to try to hit what we call on the Extension strategic initiatives of training youth about growing food and gardening. So we're hoping that we get a little bit of money and actually do some more trainings than these two that he mentioned. So look for that over the coming year to teach our next generation about gardening and growing their own food.
Well, terrific. And keep us posted. Let's go back to the phones. Kay is on the line now in Indianola. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I have an orchid question. I have two of them, and one's doing great. And the other one last summer got bumped and fell off of the stand. It was top-heavy, and it broke both blooming stems off. And my husband said, just throw it away. It'll probably never grow anymore, or these won't grow back out or anything. He didn't think, and that's what I was wondering. It seems real healthy otherwise. It's growing new roots and everything, but it hasn't done anything with the stem.
Okay. Well, as we mentioned with that one previous caller, that even though the current blooming stalks may die all the way back to the leaves, that doesn't mean that it won't bloom again. It won't bloom again on those particular stalks, but they can send out another blooming stalk from between the leaves. The leaves kind of cluster together at the base in a rosette.
Good.
So it can send out another one from just below the top leaf. And so, yes, I would say if it's looking healthy, keep it going. You probably will get some more blooms on it in the future.
Now, how much do you give fertilizer? Very often, or?
I don't fertilize often at all. I probably under-fertilize. Generally, the recommendation is that you shouldn't fertilize orchids more than once a month or every couple months. And if that, you may want to use a dilute fertilizer or even half the recommended rate on the bottle.
Yes, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, so not very often at all. They remember that most of these orchids naturally grow up in trees, so they don't pull much nutrients out of the soil at all. What nutrients they get from leaf litter that tends to fall and collect around their root system, and that's the way they get their moisture, too, is just from rainfall. So they're pretty easy maintenance, low care in that regard.
Well, I sure thank you a lot.
All right, Kay. Thanks a lot for your call, and good luck.
I hope so. Bye.
Bye-bye. Kyla's on the line next in Tiffin. And by the way, we still have room for a couple more calls this hour at 866-780-9100. Hi, Kyla.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a saucer magnolia tree that grew upward about 6 feet, and then since it's got a big green ash crouching over it, it didn't have room to grow up, and it grew sideways, parallel to the ground, about 6 feet. And I wondered how much of that that's growing parallel to the ground can I cut off without hurting the tree?
Well, I think what I would do is actually go back to a bud on the uppermost vertical stalk or stem and cut it off just above that last bud. Are you able to maybe prune the ash tree?
Yes, that's why I'm okay. I'm wanting to do that now.
So that's what I would do probably in March, is go out there and go up that vertical stem, find the uppermost bud on that vertical stem, and then cut it off just above that point.
So actually I can cut off a lot of it.
Yeah, you can, right. And any new growth then should be hopefully vertical if you don't have the shading from the ash tree.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Kyla. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Bo is on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Bo.
Good morning. Hey, question, I'm following up kind of on the ash tree. I heard this morning on the radio that the ash borer beetle has been found in Creston, mm-hmm. which, of course, is a lot closer to us here in West Des Moines. And I have five really large ash trees in my yard. And I had heard, maybe even on this program, or no, I read it in the paper, that the cities now are trying to go proactive and maybe start cutting some of these ash trees mm-hmm. ahead of time before the beetles get here. And I just wonder, from a homeowner's point of view, I mean, is that advisable? Should I start taking these trees down all the way to the ground?
Well,
I hate to do it. I just don't. I mean, it seems reasonable to me to take them down and try and start get some other trees in their place.
Right. There's a number of variables to consider as far as how many you have. You know, if you have several ash trees, that's a consideration. Also, their health or condition, that's a consideration. Here at Iowa State, we have hundreds of ash trees on our campus, and they have been very slowly removing some of the ash trees. And what they're doing is they're selecting ash trees that are maybe not in very good health, maybe declining, and removing some of those and replanting those with different trees. And they're doing that every year. So they take out a few trees 1 year, a few more the next year. And so the average person doesn't really notice the difference, really, because it's gradual. And so if you had, for example, your entire yard was ash trees, maybe it might be a good idea to maybe cut one down and replant it with another different tree. And then maybe do that maybe the following year. And maybe do this gradually over a number of years. But if you have just maybe one or two ash trees, and the other trees are maybe oaks or maples, whatever, and those trees are in good health, I would probably just keep them, enjoy them as long as you can. So it kind of depends upon how many you have. If your lawn is predominantly ash trees, I think I might start to gradually get rid of them over time.
I have seven trees, and mm-hmm. five of them are ash. The other one is a hackberry, and the seventh one is a linden.
Okay.
And they're all big. I mean, and my house is, you know, 40 or 45 years old, and all the trees are really big, you know, foot and a half or bigger on the trunk. And But there is one or two ash trees that I could pull that aren't quite as healthy as the other. So that, right. that's probably what I'll do then is aim for those.
Yeah. Select maybe one or two of maybe the ones that are maybe in poor health or not growing well, in poor shape or whatever, and remove those and put in some other trees, maybe an oak or a linden or a honey locust or whatever.
All right, Bo, thanks a lot for your call. And you can still join us at 866-780-9100. Here's a question from Jonathan in Macomb, Illinois. He says, what's more important to keep my ficus healthy during the winter, away from drafts or as much sunlight as possible? My problem is the sunniest parts of my home are also the coldest.
I would say the most important thing is to give it consistent care. They don't like any change in their care as far as lighting or temperature or anything of that nature. So moving them around in the house from room to room is a bad thing. So I would say just good, consistent care is the best way to keep them healthy.
All right. So leave it where it is.
Yep.
Okay. Back to the phones. Brandon is on the line in Humboldt. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your question?
Quick question about my dad. He has two trees in his backyard. He has a pear tree and an apple tree. Usually they grow pretty good. The size of the fruit's not usually not the greatest, but it's usually a pretty good number. A friend of mine told me that it's best to have one of each, like two pear trees and two apple trees so they can pollinate each other.
Mm-hmm.
I was just curious if the pear tree and the apple tree are pollinating each other because they seem to grow okay.
No, they cannot. So typically you need two different apple tree varieties and two different pear tree varieties. Now, they will bear some fruit by themselves, but they're not very self-fruitful. So you typically need to have two different apple varieties and two different pear varieties. But a pear cannot pollinate a apple tree and vice versa.
The other thing to keep in mind is that if neighbors or anyone nearby has another pear or apple, the bees can move from those trees to your father's tree. So if there's another tree within a quarter mile or even half mile, they're probably getting pollinated from that other tree.
And a crabapple actually is an apple. So if you have a flowering crabapple or your neighbor has one, that may suffice too.
I think he's right in the middle of a block. He's right in town. So I think they're probably just by themselves. Do you think it'd be beneficial to each tree if he tried to grow one right next to it?
Well, if you have one typically within, like, let's say 50 feet or 100 feet, that's typically what you'd have for a maximum size crop.
Okay, so something nice and close
right.
will maximize the number of apples and pears that
right.
you get. All right, Brandon, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Joe in Boone. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've planted a number of rootstock for fruit trees this last spring, and they've done really well. And I'm trying to understand exactly what I need to do from here. I understand in the early spring, maybe March, I'm supposed to cut them off at the ground level and then mound sawdust up as they grow. And then what? Am I supposed to dig the little plants out in the fall?
So let me understand. You've planted some apple rootstocks and you're trying to create more rootstocks from them, or wanting to graft them, or what do you plan to do with them?
Yeah, I planted, you know, apple, plum, pear, peach, everything, and I want to graft onto the rootstocks that I'm producing. So, but I'm just wondering what is the sort of steps I need to take to produce that the little rootstock trees that I'm going to dig up.
Okay, so if you've already planted the rootstocks, you could be grafting or budding right onto those. If you want to make more of those rootstocks, then you can do that technique you were talking about, mounding up the sawdust or soil around them to create what are called stool shoots that would start sprouting out, and then they'll get new little roots along that stool shoot. So if you're wanting to create more of the rootstocks, yes, go ahead and mound up soil or sawdust around the ones you've already planted, and as they send out new shoots, keep adding a little bit more sawdust or sphagnum so that they kind of blanch or etiolate the stems, and they're more likely to develop new roots that way. And then you can keep that going through late summer. It usually takes several months or at least a couple months to get good rooting on those, and then you can do them cut them off from the mother plant and repot them or replant them so you can get more grafts to do later on.
So then I have to wait until the following spring in order to get the scion wood. Okay.
Right.
Whatever I produce this next summer, I'll just pot it up and let it go dormant and then actually do the grafting the following spring.
Right. Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right, Joe. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Bruce in Illinois. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. Wanted some advice on vaccination of ash trees. This is my second go-round with that in the last 4 years here in western Illinois. And so far, everything has worked out quite well for us. But I'd like your comments on the merits of vaccination of the ash tree. Thank you.
You can definitely treat them. And there are various insecticides that you can use. We actually have a very good publication that you can find on our webpage at Iowa State. And so if you go to the Iowa State University homepage and type in the search box, emerald ash borer management options, you'll come across that publication where they list the various insecticides that you can use, basically how they're effective as far as what size tree, and basically follow directions on that publication. But you definitely can treat them to prevent the damage from the insect.
All right. Bruce, thanks a lot for your call. And the final question of the day, this is from Larry. He says, I recently found an Iowa nursery that's selling American elm seedlings. Are we far enough removed from the Dutch elm infestation that American elms can be considered again when selecting trees?
Well, if they're seedlings, I would say no, because you don't know their genetic resistance to Dutch elm disease. There are a number of cultivars of American elm that they have found to be Dutch elm disease resistant. But those are cultivars. Those are produced by grafting. So you have this tree. It's Dutch elm disease resistant. They can produce more trees of that type. But if you grow it from seed, you have no way to know its resistance to Dutch elm disease. So I would not be planting those.
All right. And we are out of time. Richard Geron, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Richard Geron, horticulturist with Iowa State University Extension. And Richard, our next Hort Day is actually coming up January 10th.
Correct, yes.
So have a very happy holiday and happy new year. And I will talk to you again on January 10th. Denny Schrock, thank you so much for being here today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Denny Schrock is coordinator of the Master Gardener Program and a lecturer in the Horticulture Department at Iowa State University. On our Facebook page, if you go to Iowa Public Radio, you can find a link to Iowa State University Extension information about growing moth orchids, and you can also find out information about the winter Master Gardener classes as well. And with me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. It's a News Buzz Day. What's coming
it
up,
It is.
Ben?
It's the final News Buzz of the year, as a matter of fact. We'll talk about the coating of ice that much of the state got overnight, and probably many of our listeners having a challenging commute, even
yes,
if it was short. Also, we'll talk about body armor for police dogs, and we'll talk with two Iowans. I think you've spoken with them. Their mission to run in all 99 counties in Iowa. And finally, we'll check in with Des Moines Register columnist Kyle Munson to have him share his top 10 oddball Iowa animal tales for 2013, including why Iowans are obsessed with mountain lions, even though our state, to my knowledge, Charity, has no single mountain in it.
Right. We are lacking in mountains, but strangely not in mountain lions lately. All right. That sounds great. River to River coming up today at noon. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe.